Welcome to a podcast with Walter Isaacson. Walter heads the Aspen Institute, and you've got this week coming up Aspen Ideas Festival. Mm-hmm. Big deal, isn't it?
It's kind of getting really big now. And especially this year, we have the Secretary of State, the Vice President, Mitt Romney, Newt Gingrich. But we also have some of the great scientists of our country, some of the great medical leaders.
You're going to have Donald Trump?
No, we didn't invite either of the two presidential candidates. I think it would be too disruptive. Having the Vice President...
That was a joke.
Well, we try to be nonpartisan. David Koch is on
Donald
our board.
If Donald Trump was here, I can guarantee you, nobody would get to talk but him.
That's true. We like to
now that's my comment. But Walter, you were former managing editor of Time magazine, and you were CEO of CNN, mm-hmm. and so you had a big life, busy life, and so I want to spread the welcome to those watching this Facebook Live event today for us.
I love Facebook.
Changing
media.
I want to get into the media. So much different today than it was, say, 20, 30 years ago. But not for me. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Well, for me,
I don't even have email.
You're kidding.
No, and I don't have Facebook. We had cyber specialists come in and look at us to see how easy we could be hacked and everything, and got down to the last, they said, they won't hack you. And I said, they sure won't. All I have is a yellow pad. And they can stick me up, get the yellow pad, knock me in the head, take the yellow pad. They can't get the yellow pad, they can't get anything.
Well, so, I think I'm pretty open to hacking because I'm totally digital. I don't think I've had a yellow pad in a while.
Well, tell me, how much has changed? You can't do that. We don't have time. But mm-hmm. tell me how severe the change has been from, say, 20 years ago to what it is today.
Well, the massive change has been there used to be a few gatekeepers. When I was editor of Time, there were three magazines and three or four networks, three or four national mm-hmm. newspapers. The people who ran them got to say, that's the way it is, as you remember Walter Cronkite saying. Nowadays, anybody can disseminate information. There are hundreds of places to get it.
So there are no Walter Cronkite.
There's no person sort of saying, here's the common pool of information we all share. And that's bad in some ways, because now you can go to your corner.
At least it was screened.
Right. Now you can go to your corner of the blogosphere, and if you want to believe that the President of the United States is actually from Kenya, you'll have people who tell you that's true. And if you want to believe, you know, something like, you know, we should be a socialist nation, you can find that corner of your blogosphere. But that's even happening on cable news. It's happening on talk radio. And so I think we have less of a common bond of information.
So what it is what it is.
It fragments us, and that's why we get this type of election we have, where we've been fragmented. There's a major upside, which is you don't want a whole lot of gatekeepers screening the news from people. On the other hand, you do want to keep and try to preserve that notion that we can all have our different opinions, but we should at least share the same facts.
Well, you may remember back in the 80s, and I was very much involved in corporate governance and takeovers and everything else. And always the theme that I tried to promote there was that the CEO of a company where you have your money invested mm-hmm. needs to understand that they aren't the owner.
Right.
They're the employee.
Right.
And that used to really unnerve CEOs when I would say that. But what would happen is I buy 100 shares of stock in a company, I get a letter from the CEO, form letter, of course, but said, welcome to the stockholders. Right. You're a very smart guy for picking our company to invest your money in. Then I get an offer for the stock, and it's substantially above the price I paid. Say I paid $10.
They want you out of it.
And I get $15 offer, and I hope to have $15 5 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And now I have $15 like this. You know, and so Then the CEO comes back and says, hold it, hold it. Don't be a short-term holder.
Right.
You don't want that. Let me tell you what you want. You want to be a long-term holder. And, you know, now all at once, at first I was smart for making the investment. Now I'm not smart enough to know whether to sell it for 50% more than I paid for it. And so then I was identified as a quick buck artist.
Right.
And I said, well, who would want to be a slow buck artist? So, but it's interesting as it moves forward and the roles change and education, of course, on a lot of these subjects. Okay, you did biographies on, I was interested, Albert Einstein.
Yeah.
I was interested in all of them, but Henry Kissinger, and you had Steve Jobs, and you had, let me think, another.
Ben Franklin.
Yeah, Ben Franklin.
Don't forget good Dr. Franklin.
But the one that I know Kissinger, and I never knew Jobs. He was, you know, contemporary, but the others were a little bit older than I am. But I made a speech in Des Moines last year and said that never voted for anybody but a Republican for president of the United States. And the guy said, who was the first person you voted for president? And I said, it'd have to be Abe Lincoln. And the audience hesitated at least 10 seconds before they left.
I'm glad I left quickly.
And, yeah, and I thought, gosh, this is a slow crowd. Or
oh, you're looking old.
Yeah, one or the other. They believe me. But tell me, do you have others that you're going to?
Yeah, I'll tell you who I'm working on. First of all, to say all the people I've worked on, one of the things I've learned, the most important thing I've learned, is that if you connect the humanities to the technology or the arts to the sciences, if you can stand at that intersection, which Steve Jobs always said, I stand at the intersection of arts and technology. It's what Ben Franklin did and others. So I'm doing the ultimate person in history who was the greatest artist and also the greatest engineer of his time, Leonardo da Vinci.
Okay. But he was at the crossroads too?
Yeah, well, you know, we know him as an artist from The Last Supper and the Mona Lisa. But he thought of himself primarily as an engineer, an inventor, a scientist. He does great studies of anatomy, of flight. He sort of comes up with a notion of a corkscrew-like thing that could be a helicopter. So I wanted to show that people who like both arts and technology, those are the Steve Jobses we've had.
Hey, I'm trying to think, could I find myself in the spot maybe
what do you lack,
a lesser
the arts?
Role? I understand. But
well, you're
I'm
certainly
not
an engineer.
No, I'm a geologist.
Well,
but,
close.
Okay.
So was he. You know, he, if you look at Virgin of the Rocks, which is one of his most beautiful paintings, you see the strata of the rocks there. And he understood the difference between igneous and, you know, the sedimentary
metamorphic
type. Yeah, and you see the rock layers, and that's because he spent a lot of time studying geology.
Well, you know, I'm still trying to fit myself in. I haven't had.
You haven't yet painted the Mona Lisa, have you?
No, but I'm thinking, what is, and I am truly a, I have given a lot of money to a number of causes, and that's not art, but could that be associated?
Well, I think if you appreciate art and you tie it in with what you do, nobody is going to be like Leonardo, be both a good artist and a good engineer. The problem is when you separate yourself and you're somebody in the humanities like myself and you say things like, well, I don't understand science, or I think math is too hard, or I don't know the difference between a transistor and a resistor. That's contemptuous of the science side, just like a scientist who said, well, I would never read Shakespeare, that's a waste of time. So I think whatever side of the fence you're on, you should at least try to appreciate the beauty of what lies on the other side of the fence.
Well, maybe the other side of the fence for me is philanthropy.
Mm-hmm. And you probably have arts in your philanthropy program, too.
I love art. I have Western art,
well, that's
and
okay.
I understand Western art, okay. But I don't consider myself to be a
well, you know what? Neither you or I are going to be Leonardo da Vinci, so
that's right.
I don't have to worry.
I'm not even going to be a Western artist, which I would like to do if I could. But that is your...
That's my next book, next big project. I like big biographies. You know, I've done a couple of books that were collective biographies like The Innovators and an earlier book I did with a friend called The Wise Man.
Which well, that The Innovators is your new book.
Well, that came out a year or so ago.
And it was bestseller.
Yeah, it came out after I did Steve Jobs, and I love Steve Jobs. I thought he was totally transformative. If I'm looking right now, you're using an iPhone and an iPad to make this work. So we know how Steve has transformed everything. But the important thing, when I asked Steve Jobs, you know, near the end of his life, what was the best thing you ever invented? I thought he'd say the iPhone or the iPad or the original Macintosh. He said, no, the team at Apple. Because inventing a product is hard, but what's really hard is creating a team that'll continue to make good products. So I realize that creativity is a collaborative effort, that innovation is a team sport. And we biographers have a dirty secret, which is we make it seem like there's some guy or gal who goes into a garage or a garret, they have a light bulb moment and innovation happens. I realize that it's really collaboration and putting together teams, you know this from your business, that make innovation happen. So I wrote a book called The Innovators, and it was about the internet and the computer, who invented them. Most important inventions of our time. But with all due respect to Al Gore, if you say who invented them, people wouldn't know. And that's because there's no one person.
Do you really believe Al did it?
Actually, Al Gore gets a bit of a bum rap. He shouldn't have, you know, he
shouldn't have claimed it.
And he never really claimed it, but it kind of was a mushy words. But what happened was the internet was a very private thing. A normal person in the 1980s couldn't just dial up and go on the internet. And he passed the Gore Act of 1992, right before he became vice president. And that Gore Act said that the internet, which was really only for government contractors and research universities, they had to open it up to things like AOL and CompuServe or anybody who wanted to dial in.
And they had to have a .com.
That was the Gore Act of 1992. So he did not only help fund the internet because he passed the bills that allowed DARPA and others to create the internet, but he was the one who made it not a government thing, but something that had a .com component, and you or I or anybody else could set up things on the internet or get to it. So he deserves some credit. I know people make fun of him, but
they do make fun of it. You know, I think there are other situations, probably somewhat like Al Gore. I mean, that mm-hmm. somebody should get some credit right. for what they've done. And Al Gore, smart guy, and he, but he should have had somebody else. Say.
Oh, but you know, I looked into this. First of all, he didn't say I invented the internet. He said, you know, I was there helping with the creation of the internet. And it's like on a Wolf Blitzer TV show. So it was just an interview.
He wasn't claiming it.
Yeah, it wasn't like he gave a speech in which he claimed credit. He just kind of stumbled through and answered a Wolf Blitzer.
Well, see, I don't even remember who he did it with.
Yeah. Well, we have to research that when we do books. Like, what did he mean and why did he say
were
it?
Were you at CNN when that happened?
No, I don't think so. I was at Time Magazine up until about the year 2000, 2001, and then went to CNN. And so I don't think I was there for that interview. I was probably still at Time Magazine.
The a name at Time, 1985, I believe, but Friedel Unger.
Friedel Unger, yeah, wonderful man. How did you know Friedel?
He did a story on me.
Yeah, no, I think I remember that story.
It was a Time cover.
Yeah. When you were talking about your corporate days and, you know, corporate governance, I was about to mention, but I knew you already knew it, that we put you on the cover of Time.
That's
for that,
right.
And Friedel wrote it.
I met his wife, Barbara. Mm-hmm. Barbara, was that right?
Yeah.
We got to be friends.
Mm-hmm. Those were in the good days of the media where somebody like a Friedel Unger wasn't trying to make a name for himself by doing some nasty or, you know, over-the-top story or sensationalist story. You could have people doing stories who really tried to get it straight and get it right and then be friendly
enough
with the subject.
He came and traveled with me.
Yes.
And we were together for the better part of a month.
Those are the good old days, too, when you could assign a reporter for a full month to write a story.
And he was...
The business model didn't allow that.
He went to my ranch with me. He was in my home. and stayed overnight two or three times.
That was the upside of the old way of doing media.
Well, that's where...
Is there was a business model, and you had enough money. So if somebody's going to write a cover story for Time Magazine, they'd spend a month doing it. Nowadays, you got to turn out three stories a day for the Internet.
Well, this period was a time when, one, I never was suspicious of reporters. It cost me, but it also made good friendships, and Friedel and I met each other and didn't know names were all, and then got to know each other. I did.
And you got to be on the cover of Time, and that meant something back then.
Well, but it was, I got to know him before the cover.
Yeah.
And I don't think the cover had been decided. I don't think he came and was doing a cover story. He may have been.
No. I remember on Friday when I was editor, even before, you'd spend Friday nights and you had two or three choices, and you'd sit around all Friday debating what cover are we going to go with. So you made it. Yeah.
Well,
but, you know, it was important back then. If I were running Time Magazine now, I'd sort of go back to think, let's put somebody on the cover every week. Somebody we can introduce people to. Great concert pianist, a great artist, you know, a corporate raider,
sure.
Whatever it may be. Not raider. Corporate governance expert.
You know, now you know what they call them, of course.
Activist investors. Yeah. I've been on a board and... you know, you get activist investors and everybody, you know, acts like it's a special breed of wildcat or something.
Carl Icahn. I'm older than Carl.
He's still doing it, right?
Sure he is. But Carl's junior age to me.
Sure.
And I don't hesitate to politely let him know sometimes.
Yeah. Be respectful to his elders.
Yeah. Okay. But Carl and I were talking about it, and I said, I didn't hang around long enough to be an activist.
You got stuck with the Raider label instead of activist?
I faded out as a Raider, and he's an activist.
Well,
so. But what else is on your mind?
Well, you know, I'm a little bit disappointed in this political season. One of the things we try to do at the Aspen Institute is say, no matter what ideology you have, we share certain values, and so let's figure out what ideas we can do based on our common values. And now, because of the media, because of the politics, I think the primary system's been a mess, people are pulled apart, and they're more hateful and more vicious.
But everything's partisan, too.
Right, that's what I meant. And it used to not be that way. And, you know, The Wise Men, the book I told you about I wrote 100 years ago, was about three Democrats and three Republicans who worked together to create the foreign policy in the old early days of the Cold War. And so I worry about the...
Who were they?
Dean Acheson, Averill Harriman, Bob Lovett, John McCloy, Chip Bolin, and George Kennan. People were not very well known. We were lucky that some publisher was willing to publish this book, but they worked together in the early days.
Well, Dean Acheson, he was Secretary.
Secretary of State for Truman. Lovett was, you know, both at Defense and State for a long time. Harriman was famous, you know, he was special envoy or whatever.
Yeah.
Kennan and Bolin were Russia hands. So it was fun. But it was like putting together a team, you know, going back to my view about collaboration and teams, that was the case where Truman knew how to put together, and Eisenhower, both, they worked for both presidents, knew how to put together teams, and we knew how to rise above partisanship. And so at the Institute, you know, all this coming week, we're going to be at Ideas Festival, and we're trying to have people who represent different viewpoints in a civil discussion instead of this debate and crossfire.
Where you're trying to hammer somebody.
Right.
And make them look stupid or something.
Right. And
well, I have an idea.
Yes, sir.
That the United States has more natural gas than any other country in the world.
Yeah. You and I talked, you don't remember, but you and I talked about this when you were doing your plan for natural gas.
Yes, the Pickett's plan.
Correct.
Okay, but the natural gas, you should take advantage of it. One, it's cleaner.
Sure.
And just for instance, if you took the 18 wheelers, 8 million of them, off the road or diesel and put natural gas, it would be a huge change in carbon emissions.
I was at a meeting the president convened of people because he wanted to try to do that with Fred Smith, who did, you know, knew FedEx, all these things, which is, it's a chicken and egg thing, as you know. You have to be able to get natural gas, you know, pumping stations in places where fleets can refuel and do it across America.
Believe it or not, that's in. That's called a natural gas highway.
Right. But, you know, if I were driving a natural gas vehicle and I was driving from here to Denver, I wouldn't know what to do. So,
but I'm not talking about
you. I know. You need the fleets. You need the FedExes, like we were saying. So I think President Obama is very interested in that, which is good. I come from Louisiana. You know, I grew up watching them flare off natural gas because it was too cheap and no reason to try to capture it. And I'm watching the shale revolution, which has been very Aspen has an energy program, and, you know, we've looked very much at how to do fracking, you know, well, so that we can extract this unconventional sources of gas. But we're trying to gather people at the Institute just on this very thing, which is gas can be an important part for our national security as well as our economic security.
Yeah, the economic, you can rebuild the economy in the United States on the back of cheap energy.
Right, right.
And the only way you're going to pay off that $19 trillion in debt, you have got to have an economy that's 5, 6, 7% to ever hope to pay it off, I think.
Right, but as you said in the Pickens plan and when we talked about it last time, it's important to get transportation fleets to use it because that's where you're we're most addicted to oil and to gasoline.
3 million barrels a day is what it costs us for the heavy-duty trucks.
Yeah, and you could probably get buses and other, you know, fleet-type vehicles.
Oh, sure.
And then eventually, maybe cars.
Well, you're getting there, Walter. You're just not getting there very fast.
Right, right. And what do you think that the falling price of oil, it's now going back up a bit, do you think that's hurt the process of instituting natural gas and other alternative sources?
Sure, because diesel's cheaper.
Yeah.
And so diesel's come down. But the people using diesel, big truckers, you mentioned Fred Smith, and Fred and I work on this together. And,
right, that's
and,
why we
had, FedEx invited, getting ready to open a regional station.
And you were adding wind power into the Pickens plan, too.
Yeah,
right?
But you're restricted because natural gas is too cheap.
Right.
And so you have to really subsidize the wind if you want to get it in large quantities. But gosh, you could take the wind from Sweetwater, Texas, all the way to the Canadian border. Mm-hmm. And that is a corridor. That is, it's the best wind in the world.
No, and that would be smart. I think the next, you know more than I do on this, the next big thing that'll help transform this is a leap in battery technologies.
Yes. Battery, good. It won't work for heavy-duty trucks.
Oh, no. But what you want...
For your car and my car.
Yeah, well, I have, you know... we use an electric car sometimes. So, and then, you know, it's not quite ready yet. Once again, I'm not ready to drive from Washington to New York City in an electric car because I've got to figure out where on, you know, the New Jersey Turnpike I can plug it in.
But you take the places that you can use it and develop it. And if there's anything that comes after that, it'll be because of first responders in it that used it. Not your car, my car, but heavy-duty trucks, the Fred Smiths of the world, BNSF, they're going to go to it.
Well, you know, what President Obama's done is make sure the military does it, and that helps kick it in too, right?
You're sure the military uses it?
They're using natural gas vehicles some, right?
I haven't. Okay. If they have,
well, you would know.
I know they've talked about it, but I haven't seen it happen.
Okay. Yeah. Well, this all comes from my old friend who you almost forgot about, Ben Franklin, because he's the one who understands for the first time the single fluid theory of electricity. Now, we think of him as some doddering old guy, some dude flying a kite in the rain. But those kite experiments and electricity
experiments... It's not the way I remember.
Yeah, well, But his experiments on electricity were the most important experiments of the time. And you know where the word battery comes from? He first used the word battery because they were using Leyden jars to capture the electricity. You're old enough to remember what a Leyden jar is. And he said, well, let's put them in rows.
You're
like this.
Fruit jars?
No. I'm talking about the Leyden jar from that was the first, had tin foil and glass.
No, I don't.
This is in the 1760s, so maybe it was before your time. But in the, it was named after the city of Leyden, but they captured static electricity by rubbing the glass, and then the inner piece of metal would be charged, and you could do something with it. So it was like the first holder of a charge, like a capacitor. And Franklin, when they did the electricity experiments in Philadelphia, I think in the 1750s, put a whole bunch of these jars together, and he called it a battery. And that's how we get the name battery.
It was battery.
A battery of jars that held electricity. And so he becomes the first to understand both lightning and the power of electricity.
Yeah. Well, Walter, it's been a pleasure having you on my podcast.
Well, it's interesting for me.
Good.
Good to see you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.